Take RFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This programme was first broadcast on RFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, resilience on radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, resilience on radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here tonight because I'm in Lappeenranta in Finland. Each week we talk with somebody who is making a positive difference and we try to see the world through their sustainable perspective. Tonight's Sustainable Lens is that of Dr. Valentine Cadieu, who is Director of Environmental Studies and the Director of Sustainability at Hamline in St. Paul, Minnesota. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for thinking I'm making a positive difference.
You've got a good story.
That's true.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in New England in the northeast of the United States. I was born in Boston, moved around quite a lot. I had an itinerant childhood and lived in New England, ending up in Boston all the way through university.
Holidaying on a lake?
I spent time on lakes, and I spent a lot of time at the ocean. So it's a wet region.
Mm-hmm. And what did you want to be when you grew up?
I was very interested in being a fighter pilot until I realized that they fight.
Had clues in the name.
I know. But the aeronautics engineering part of it was very exciting to me. And my dad was an engineer. And it stuck through high school. I was at the very beginning of the computer era of career counseling. We got these dot matrix printouts, and I was told I should be either an art counselor or an aeronautics engineer. And I thought, and then I did neither of those things. And when I went to university, I got very excited about folklore and mythology, which was a possible course of study. And then I discovered it was like glorified linguistics, and I couldn't understand any of my professors, and that lasted for exactly one semester. So when I realized that folklore and mythology wasn't all it was cracked up to be, I was really struck at this point. I'd grown up in a fairly working class, hands-on learning environment, and I really liked reading, and I had been really excited about learning, and I hit this very interesting class divide, and I ended up being in a somewhat unusual program that was called Visual and Environmental Studies, and it had been a marriage of anthropologists doing documentary filmmaking and architects, many of whom had emigrated from the Bauhaus and were German emigres, and it was their students. And they had this extremely broad understanding of environment as everything around people, and this human-environment interaction as something that needed to be engaged in this very active and exploratory way. And it was by the 90s when I was there, a somewhat awkward marriage of documentary film, environmental design, and studio arts. But it was a lovely place.
Did they manage to integrate those?
I don't know that I would say they were integrated, but they were co-housed in a way that for the experience of them could be very integrated. And I would talk my way into the seminars for environmental science and public policy. So I thought that I had the best of both worlds. I did not have to take organic chemistry, and I could go do field work in which one of the persistent challenges was in the Boston area where I was. People who had lived there for their entire lives were being priced out by rising property values and rising tax levels, and so we would be dragged out to some community and had, you know, a hands-on workshop of how do you deal with this? How are the school teachers going to keep living here once they've retired? And we'd have to go out and interview people in the grocery store and find people's stories and how to engage them. So it's So it was a good combination.
Well, it sounds absolutely fascinating to me. I would have done it. Some people would run a mile at that combination. Had you always had a thing for social environmental awareness?
I think that wouldn't necessarily have been called that, but I had a very lucky childhood. Although we moved around a lot, and maybe partly because we moved around a lot, I felt very incentivized to explore the woods behind my houses. And one of the things that I realize now is an extreme privilege of the New England region is that, and less now that it's quite expensive to live there, but especially for those who can't afford the central cities, there are a lot of places that have access to woods, and there's a great deal of public land. And so as long as you can get to the public land, and there's a decent transit system and a lot of public access, you could be outside. And my parents had grown up in cities, but in a relatively unsupervised way, so it was normal for them to just send us out, and we'd be out all day. And I think going to university in the city made me realize that not everyone had that experience and that it was important. And I think that the social awareness around it arose partly because as I started to make art about landscape, people would come and tell me these stories that really systematically erased humans from the landscape. So I had this very dramatic experience. I ended up doing a series of photographs about the reforestation of the New England farming landscape, because I thought that was a story that there had been this great deal of effort and a great deal of colonial struggle, and to the degree that it was allowed to reforest, people could absolve themselves of this history and not feel like it was part of their identity. And I think now I would talk about that in much more post-colonial terms than I would have 30 years ago, but it was something I was trying to explore. And when people come into my studio, and you know, which they do a lot when you're a student, you have your art up on the wall and people want to discuss it. They wanted to discuss it in terms of wilderness and something that people elsewhere in the world may not realize is that the United States, and maybe everyone knows this about the United States, is that they just gutted geography in the 1940s for interesting political reasons that I won't go down that rabbit hole. But once a couple of really prominent schools had gotten rid of their geography departments, it took out over half of the geography departments in the United States. So people's geographic and environmental historical knowledge is extremely low. And I really struggled to find who would be the people who would help me problematize wilderness. You know, so I remember this one day where someone came in and looked at this photograph I was working really hard on. I was very interested in using old photographic processes. So each photograph took 40 hours. And this woman is looking at the photograph and saying, "Oh, this reminds me of the virgin forest where I grew up in New Hampshire." And I got all excited and said, "Oh, where is that? Because there are only about 2 acres of, you know, like there's less than a hectare of virgin forest left in New Hampshire." And just the idea that people are obsessed with the virginity of their forest is itself really interesting. And she got kind of confused and defensive and was like, no, all of that forest was wilderness. It had never been touched. And, you know, I'm 20 and interested in things. I was like, let's talk about this. And she started crying and ran out of my studio. And I thought, all right, I've tapped into something that's much bigger than I can understand. And then I started to realize the degree to which selling this kind of art on a market not only fed into a kind of commoditization of art that I didn't like, but it also encouraged people to feel like they could buy these environments. And I was profoundly uncomfortable with that. So I more or less put my art career on hold for the next 20 years and went and became a geographer. So I started to look around for programs where people were understanding how to collaboratively manage rural environments. And everywhere I looked in the United States, people told me what defines rural environments is that they are unplanned. They don't have management. That's what makes them rural. And I thought, that seems like a profound understanding of my experience of the world. Someone else must have an answer. And I eventually went to graduate school in Canada, where every municipality has planners, no matter how rural.
And still has geography.
And still has geography. So I was happy.
You did an MA?
I did, yeah, both my MA and PhD at the University of Toronto in geography, right as they had a planning PhD program that was in the works at that time. So it was great because I had a lot of classes that were about half academic geographers and half practitioner planners coming for their credentialing.
And what was your thesis on?
my thesis was on the imagination of wilderness and the understanding of landscape. So I got started there, and then I ended up going into understandings of productive environments in urban places. So this is part of how I ended up coming to Aotearoa, New Zealand, because I kept asking people, what do you do with your land? And, you know, what do you do in your garden? And my master's work, I interviewed 50 households who lived in the outskirts of the Toronto metropolitan region. And there's this really interesting, there had been someone in the 70s who had done work that was basically landscape change between the 50s and the 70s. And so I found his work and decided I would do between the 70s and the 90s and see if I could update that in a couple of those sites. So I went out household to household and knocked on doors. And with the exception of only one family that had lived there, so they were not urban to rural migrants, almost all the other 49 households explained how they were rural people at heart. They had this very uniform idea. But then they would ask, well, they would say, I moved out here because I really wanted to live with farmers. And then they would ask, do you know any? And it was this really tragic. I mean, I became really interested in this because they would then have a lot of advice they would seek about their environments. And they had basically moved away from a city where they could have seen their neighbors. I mean, Toronto has some of the most active urban agriculture in the world, very, very vibrant agrarian immigrant communities. So if you want to know how to pinch tomatoes correctly and trellis them up three stories on the back of your house, you just need to be in neighborhoods where people are doing that, which are very accessible. On your way to the bus, when I was biking home from my classes, I would see tomato juice running out from the backyards of Italian and Portuguese households because they grew enough to can in little tiny, very, very dense urban areas. And so people were both moving out and being isolated from that kind of knowledge. There was this great study done at the time that people were mowing, often 5 to 10 hectare lots, because mowing was what they knew to do. With mowing grass was what you did. So they'd be like, I moved out here and now I spend all of my time mowing. And then they were moving into these very constrained, almost kind of like gated suburban communities rather than being actually near what they had imagined it. So then this kind of flipped me around. I became really interested in, well, what keeps people in cities and how do people engage in what they imagine to be these desirable rural lifestyles while living in cities? So that was then, you know, when I was asking people about urban agriculture and urban forestry, people kept saying, well, you have to go to Christchurch and you have to see what's happened to the greenbelt there. And it was right at the time that the apple fields had been taken out and had turned into suburban developments. So I went to interview people there. And I'd asked my committee, I said, well, I'd like to take some time off. Everyone says I need to do this. And they said, don't be an idiot. This is part of your project. Just go ask the questions there. And then while I was there, Toronto Metropolitan Region, working with my supervisor at the time, put in a 2 million hectare greenbelt around the Toronto metropolitan area. So it became a very interesting 10 years of work comparing a region that decided it didn't need a greenbelt anymore with a region that decided it suddenly needed a greenbelt, both with the same British colonial, almost exactly the same urban planning language.
There's some really interesting urban ecology going on in the red zone.
Well, this is part of what I've been very interested in. So I came back a few years ago, and part of what was fascinating is, you know, I'd spent almost a year interviewing people and trying to understand the remnants. So I did these kind of transects because I didn't have an old study like that to work with. I would go from the city center out to the edges around Christchurch and just seeing what people were doing. And this whole kind of quarter acre Pavlova paradise idea was very strong. And at the same time, all this infill development and local food movement was taking off, and the whole kind of the seeds of the food resiliency planning were planted. This is in 2003 and 2004. And so then coming back, it was 12 years later, talking to planners, there was still this really interesting resistance, but it existed side by side with this, not even acquiescence, but just competing awareness. So I had one of the best conversations I've ever had with a planner, where I was just asking, tell me about food resiliency as it's showing up in these new plans. He was like, well, you know, a lot of this is rubbish. You can't just grow enough cabbages in Christchurch to feed the people in Christchurch. And then he looked around and he's like, well, I mean, I suppose you could. Well, maybe that's actually quite a good idea. And it was just wonderful because it was, you know, this is part of what I have seen, what I have learned is one of the real strengths of the sustainability movement is to get people to say their objections out loud in a tone they can hear when it is extraordinarily plausible that the thing they're objecting to would actually be something they would quite like. So rather than to say, like, you should grow cabbages, it was an example he had brought up and then talked himself into in only three short iterations of the idea. And I didn't have to make a face or... there was no interaction really at all. It was all him. And from what I hear, part of what's really cool in the Red Zone is that a lot of the fruit trees and existing... there had been a lot of... So right as I was leaving 2004, there were two really interesting things happening that I've been very curious about. Three interesting things. One was more rural, which was the very first application to the Environment Court for a dairy permit had been overturned. And the several million dollars had already been invested for the dairy because no one expected that the Environment Court would ever rule against dairy. And it was after the third aquifer had been gone into for the irrigation water. So there was a kind of seismic shift in the way that people were thinking about water and agricultural ecologies. And then the second thing that really was interesting to me, also around water ecologies, is that a lot of the old drainage was being replaced and that the wooden drains were so expensive to replace. They had so much opportunity cost to work with. A lot of wetland restoration was happening. And then the third thing was a lot of people were joining up their back gardens into communally managed whole blocks. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I came back, I tried to get a sense of whether those dynamics had an impact on the way that what happened in the Red Zone played out. But it feels like the kind of place that, especially an outsider doing research at this point, that would need different conditions. Like, there would need to be questions people wanted to ask because people were exhausted and that's the last thing they were thinking about at that time.
There's quite some positive things happening. I had a conversation with Alex Davies of The Gatherings. It's a restaurant assistant. Let's call it a sustainable restaurant. It's entirely locally sourced, and lots of it comes scavenged from the Red Zone. And, you know, there's this particular area where presumably there was a Greek family or something that there's this thing growing, and so that's what they're cooking for the week. And I don't know how long that'll last before it gets paved over or whatever it is they're planning to do to it, but for the moment it's a real treasure. And so there's interesting conversations happening around that. That might be a useful way in.
Well, and it seemed like a really good sign, even at the time, that they were taking houses down where they needed to, but deciding to leave the fruit trees in the gardens. And that, I mean, just this history of different ecologies encountering each other and then reseeding in these places. Yeah, I mean, and so much of what was left, even by the beginning of the 2000s, was what was perennial. And so it does seem to have a potentially very long history. Especially along the river edges where a lot of renativization was happening with the ecologies.
So you're in St. Paul, Minnesota?
I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota most of the time these days.
And what's it like there?
It's very interesting. I was called a Minnesotan for the first time just last week after living there for almost 12 years. So I thought that was interesting and welcoming. It's a very different kind of place from anywhere else I've lived, although it's probably closest. I lived in Toronto for 7 years while I was in graduate school and working for an environmental organization there. And I think the significant amounts of German immigration to both Ontario and Minnesota have created it's still almost a third of the population has German heritage in Minnesota. So there's a very orderly governance culture, and especially being originally from Massachusetts, which has a very disorderly and somewhat corrupt governance culture, I appreciate that, you know, things work. The government is quite engaged with the community. There's a very high focus on equity and what would be needed to achieve it. But on the other hand, it's some of the most concentrated in separated areas of wealth, and it's one of the most racially segregated cities in the United States, the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan region. So there's a lot of work to do. I notice when I go to other places that that work is often not even on the table. So I think especially after spending a lot of time living in both Canada and at least some time visiting Aotearoa New Zealand, there's this sense of coloniality that's just missing in the U.S. And I think Minnesota, partly because the indigenous community there is one of the largest in the urban areas, that those questions don't fall off the table. They're there, and there's racial equity is kind of front and center in most of the conversations, especially around housing and land and further development of the cities, at least in the circles that I encounter. And I recognize, so say, I teach at Hamlin, which is a very social justice-oriented institution, so I probably have a bubble there, but most of, I go to a lot of food policy council meetings in both of the cities, and there's this strong effort to figure out what it means to do things equitably, and it's a very interesting place to teach for that reason.
It would be. What's the environment like?
It's a very undense metropolitan region, so in many ways it would reflect the kind of suburban structure of a lot of cities like Christchurch or Dunedin. It's just hitting a very strong growth density spike in property values, which has been slower there than elsewhere. So I moved during the financial crisis, and so it had been hit quite hard by the very last round of predatory lending. So the mortgage default displacements, especially in immigrant neighborhoods, were extraordinary for a while. But on the other hand, it's a place where there's a lot of diversity in housing. So the places that were hardest hit were where all the houses cost the same amount, and no matter how hard you had to stretch, if you felt you needed to live there because your employment was there, it probably meant you got displaced. What's happening now is that it's traditionally been a place that was so easy to buy a house, but there's not enough rental housing. Rental housing hasn't expanded at the same rate that condos have, and now the housing market has tightened up a lot and gotten more expensive. So there's an increasing housing crisis, which has driven the politics of both cities. And it's very salient for me because one of the main things I do there is help people gain access to agricultural land. So I help run a nonprofit land trust that's called the Twin Cities Community Agricultural Land Trust. And under a regime of densityism, it can be really hard to make it relevant to someone that growing food is as relevant as housing. So we spend a lot of time showing people how green the city is and how green the city is likely to remain. Almost somewhere around 16% of both of the major cities there, Minneapolis and St. Paul, are owned by their respective park boards. So quite a large portion of the city will remain in parks. And there's this very strong civic-mindedness of an idea that you can't just allow someone to grow food in a park because that's private gain at public expense. So through a somewhat slow, painstaking, and very community-engaged process, both cities now have programs where they're starting to allow people to grow food in parks as long as it's not for a profitable business. So there's these slow realizations. This is kind of like you can't grow cabbages in Christchurch, that it's not a zero-sum game, that you could put a quite dense apartment building up and you could still have an orchard around it, or you could grow things on the roof, or there's still these giant corporate lawns that are lawns.
So Minnesota, a lot of lakes.
Over 10,000. We brag.
10,000. Do you like walking on the street and one jumps out and gets you?
Pretty much, especially at this time of year because so one of the things that's fascinating, for some reason in North America, I think just because the preponderance of the rivers flow from north to south, people don't think about south to north flowing rivers. And especially in the northern part of Minnesota, they're in the Red River Valley, which thaws at its headwaters before it thaws at its delta. So it floods tremendously every year. And then, and just in general, because of the way that agriculture has drained previous wetlands.
Because it goes up through Minnesota, doesn't it? It goes up through Winnipeg and stuff.
Exactly. Yes. So it It drains out the top part of North America, which is very unusual for North American rivers. And even in the south draining rivers, we've had tremendous flooding. So the rivers are slightly more likely to jump out and get you. But part of what's cool, this is a really fun thing to show visitors, for, especially from an urban sustainability perspective, is if you go out to the suburbs where all people's summer's cottages and expensive houses are, the lakes are all ringed by big houses with boat docks and motorboats and oil slicks. So if you're in the water, you're being mowed down by motorboats and it's smelly. And when you look around, there's just lawns coming down. Whereas in the city, there are zoning requirements so that there's a setback and you can't use motorboats. So the urban lakes, you know,
are better than the ones further away.
Right. I mean, tremendously. So you have this, and it was something, you know, I really appreciated this living in Christchurch, was the fact that people would come to the beach and they'd walk on the beach and they'd collect shellfish on the beach, and there was this real sense of this being an asset, not just, I mean, this is what we think about with urban agriculture too. It's not just a visual amenity, it's a place where people are actually collecting significant amounts of household food potentially, and that you've protected a place so people can keep doing that is this real kind of community wealth. So having places that people can fish and swim and cool off. It gets quite hot. It's continental, so it's right in the middle of a quite large continent. So it gets down to negative 20 and colder in the winter. I was thinking this today because the Finns were laughing at us, but it's just as cold there. And then in the summer, it can easily be above 40 for, you know, a week or two when you get real hot weather come up through the middle of the continent. So lakes reduce stress.
Probably not quite as much sunshine as they get here in the summer. Well, it's light.
No, it's true. It's light. It's right about the same as Dunedin.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're right around the same latitude, so it's light till about after, maybe between 9 and 10 at night. But then we have a very dark sleeping period, which I'm beginning to appreciate.
So what do you do as Director of Sustainability?
So I think, like with many institutions of learning, there has been an increasing interest in trying to coordinate sustainability efforts and to integrate sustainability in a curriculum. And I ended up in this job in a really interesting way. There were two things that happened. One was that there was a cohort of 8 schools, small schools mostly, in Minnesota. So some of them were public and some were private. And that distinction has broken down, I think, considerably because the rising costs of public education and the lowered costs of private education as people are seeking students. So we were a cohort of schools that were encouraged with a 3-year grant from a local regional foundation the framing was to embed sustainability across the curriculum. So this grant created a new position. People who had been trying to get environmental studies to be a larger field jumped on this opportunity. We have had an environmental studies program since Earth Day, the first Earth Day, and it's been 5 to 10 students a year for almost 50 years now. And then I had been working, doing urban agriculture work with a group of community gardens are mostly housed at African-American churches in the neighborhood near where the school is. So when the job came up, people in the neighborhood said, we would like you to apply for this job because we want this school to be someplace that we feel like we have some claims on so that our students in our neighborhood can feel comfortable coming to the school. We want to help change the environment of the school so that it's more welcoming for our students. And that was something that the school was also interested in. So they brought me on board, and the goal was partly to figure out across, you know, we have a school of business and a school of education and a college of liberal arts, and there are the traditional havens for environmental stuff in biology. We have 3 ecologists, which is a lot for a tiny school. But then we also we have quite a large criminal justice program, and the people in criminal justice were really interested in what sustainability looks like in terms of ending incarceration. And we had people in philosophy trying to integrate sustainability into their ethics courses. So my main job, wearing my sustainability hat, is to try to figure out how to get these somewhat isolated nodes using different language for sustainability to practice together and to share ideas and assets and plans.
And so you're not having to do much work to convince them to do it there? It's already a thing they're keen to do?
Well, part of what was really fun was to take the people who were already eager to do this and to help provide them with... There's so much existing curriculum and so many resources in the world. So, you know, you'd get one person in a program who'd say, oh, you know, so this ethics course or the criminal justice course would be great examples where people said, I don't see what this has to do with sustainability. And the criminal justice one was great because we worked with them for a few years running. And you're like, well, so we do a course. We have a number of courses that take place with incarcerated people. So there'll be 12 students from Hamline and 12 students within the prison. It's called the Inside Out program. It happens at a lot of different schools. And they're like, well, we carpool. We bring a van when we go there. And I celebrate their fuel efficiency, but I was trying to explain that from a societal standpoint, you know, when we think about the social side, addressing and destigmatizing the experience of being imprisoned and rehumanizing, especially to students who haven't had experience with incarceration, making these connections and like these social pieces of sustainability dwarf that carpooling. So those were really fun because they were projects that people already had started, so they were embedded and they were willing to kind of stand up and explain it again and again to their peers. And then to be able to almost come in, I feel like a lot of what sustainability work is that people may not realize is validating what people are doing, putting it in a context where they can see why it matters. And so much had been sort of owned, and I put owned in quotes here, by the environment, that this huge, I mean, they ended up creating a five-year focus for a Center for Justice and Law that launched soon after the sustainability program of ending mass incarceration. So then to be able to have that as one of our flagship sustainability issues really was a nice turning point to say this matters in a completely different way than recycling your pop can. And then what was an interesting challenge for me and remains so is the faculty and the students quickly dug in their heels that they didn't want to put more investments, like they weren't going to be compliant with our sustainability reporting, or they weren't going to share what they were doing if we didn't make better progress on some of the operations side stuff. So my job was very explicitly curriculum and not operations. But the curriculum people quickly said, we can't teach this if we don't have the operational side as well. And the operational side people were extremely interested in sustainability, but very fearful about whether it could be afforded or not. So,
have they made the link between criminal justice and environmental justice?
I think increasingly that this is something that we've been working on, especially we've really been building our public health domain, and so we do a lot of environmental justice work there, and that makes the linkage much clearer for people. So to be able, this is why I was excited about lakes and stress, because there's great measures of the way that urban heat island effect drives increased crime. So if you can say, well, living in this kind of environment or being exposed to lead in these kinds of ways play into the likelihood of incarceration or of negative law enforcement encounters, that makes sense to people very quickly. And we have such good data on that.
Have you got your operations? I know you're not doing operations, but have you got your operations people on board in terms of, you know, improving the campus in terms of a garden? Yeah, you know, garden in quotes.
Mm-hmm. This continues to be an interesting challenge, and I think you know, we've been talking about how it's useful to foreground your challenges and start there. And so I think like many places, people in operations and especially in grounds have been tasked with making colleges beautiful. And there's this wonderful piece I've been making all of the students who are working with me on the summer grounds projects read, which is about especially liberal arts education, but really university education in general as a virtue formation exercise. That part of what happens in institutions is that you learn how to practice character in ways that are socially negotiated. And one of the arguments that's made that I think is a very interesting and understated or underappreciated one is that institutions of higher learning often promote a whole virtue set that is more consumeristic than they mean to, because they're trying to recruit students, they're trying to look really good, they're trying to be very comfortable. So, for example, we have a very manicured lawn and a Starbucks that serves fancy coffees. And we've increasingly gotten anthropologists on board and sociologists who are both really interested in the way that holding a Starbucks cup, for example, or being able to sit on an expansive lawn allow someone who's maybe never had the experience of being able to perform a middle-class lifestyle to be squarely there. But there's this danger that you're teaching someone that this is what success is, that you have a big lawn and a Starbucks cup that you can throw away and, you know, $4 coffee. And so it's been really interesting because the facilities and grounds folks who do the operations side are very eager to share their sustainability aspirations and operations. So we have permeable pavers on campus and quite a lot of renativized plantings. So they, you know, they've both of the directors of facilities and grounds have been on campus for almost 30 years. They've done an amazing job, and very resourcefully, not a lot to work with. I think it becomes a more challenging thing to put procedurally. So a great example is we ended up working with a community organization that had been working for 8 years to try to replant a highway drainage basin. They wanted a native prairie. So we said, great, what does it mean to plant a native prairie? How do we learn what this land was? And what if we have this idea that we're trying to liberate this land from its current management regime, who do we talk to? What kind of relationships does that require us to have? And right, that I think we lose a lot of people right there, because it sounds like it will take so much time and so much effort, and like there are so many people who will complain. You know, especially if what you have been doing for 30 years is mowing a lawn so no one complains about it, to say we're going to let this thing grow up and be really weedy. So we continue to do that. I have a couple of students who
was over the compost bins. A couple of people dug the heels in and said, we are not having compost bins on campus. The whole point of it was we're trying to, you know, bring sustainability to front of house. We didn't want it to be tucked away in the services area. And we didn't do it for a couple of years. And then we had a new director of campus services, or whatever his job title was, and he put the compost bin under his office window.
That's brilliant. It's such a, well, and this is part of what I've really loved working with anthropologists. So I'm housed in an anthropology department with my academic job. And for example, if we're sorting through the waste, they'll say, wait, let's get the hazmat suits. And we'll put on the full suits and have the booties and the needle-proof gloves, which are both more responsible, but it's also let's get into the mode. So this idea that you're performing compost being okay. Because it's tragic that it was stopped, because when I first came, I believe it was a collaboration between your institution and one in Christchurch, and they were in the early 2000s trying to use effective microorganisms to see if you could make smell-proof compost bins in urban gardens, and they were working with the hospitality folks. So you can see, right, these things come in waves. So this was the really fascinating thing. A couple of weeks ago, our grounds people asked us to move our gardens, and we still are trying to figure out why. And we think that they maybe this is the vegetable garden. So we have vegetable gardens. We have a student-led food reclamation and food provision service, because one of the things that's happening around the world is people are realizing that just because you're able to afford a post-secondary education doesn't mean you can afford food. And in fact, may not be able to afford food because you're affording secondary education. So students have done great work trying to figure out grants and resources and how they can help each other and how they can destigmatize this and make food access and food literacy part of what it means to be educated. So we've just been growing out a bunch of vegetables, and we were just in the process of getting them planted and building. The student Congress had granted us a bit more money to put walls on the beds of the garden so we could keep rabbits out. And facilities got a sense that this isn't what a college campus looks like and asked us to redig the bin about 2 meters away. And in this set of conversations, it was just so interesting because gardens don't look right, but then they're like, you can put the compost bins right here. So I thought it was fascinating. And then the next thing on the list, they were like, a picnic table. No, we don't really want a picnic table. So a piece, and I still, I mean, all I can imagine is that a picnic table they're afraid will encourage people to come and, like, drink beer after hours or smoke cigarettes and leave them on the ground. That they're thinking, what are the things that create attractive nuisance or hazard? But what it's done to the rest of my life is that I've ended up restructuring the environmental studies program. So we now have these tracks, and one of the tracks, the informal name that the students call it, is the Bureaucracy Warriors Program. So we take advantage. We have a lot of public administration and nonprofit management classes in our business school, and we have a lot of conflict resolution courses. We have a certificate program in conflict studies. And so we've assembled. It's like, okay, so we're going to run into these things. These are not a bug. These are design. This is what social change looks like, is that you'll get resistance and you'll spend a lot of time engaging with the bureaucracy. So I don't know how much the administration likes this, but I've tried to figure out, well, what are the respectful ways that we can bring students into these conversations and recognize that having conversations about how we grapple with things is the central task for institutional sustainability.
Are you allowed to teach them to be activists?
Yes, we have. So part of what's lovely is that on one hand, so there are two hands here. So the thumbs up hand is we have a social justice program. That's really a big part of what is characteristic. And all the students go out and do internships, most of which are social organizing internships. And it's one of our flagship programs. And our dean is really, we've been meeting women's studies and conflict studies and some of the area studies, basically a lot of the socially engaged programs that think of their pedagogy as transformative are trying to figure out what are more pathways into social change learning. And I keep arguing that it should be social change and sustainability, because I think in the United States at least, social change is effectively code for engaged with the civil rights and with racial justice. But I think it's really useful. I would love it if sustainability could also more legibly mean remembering that many of the things we seek to sustain are going well. Most of what we do as humans is great. We love each other. We love the land. We're wonderful. We have a lot of very sustainable practices. It's really a minority of the things we do that we need to stop doing or do differently. So I speak up for sustainability occasionally to say, let's not assume we have to change everything. That seems overwhelming and daunting. We just need to change the things that aren't working.
But one of the challenges that you have is the people that think, well, actually, my curriculum's already full. How am I going to cram? You want me to put what in?
Part of what's nice at this point is that I'm standing on generations of giants who have had that exact same problem before. So it's the interesting thing I found is it's not hard to get people to teach sustainability. It's hard to get them to report on what they're doing and to share it with other people. So we've worked a lot with people in languages, because you're teaching someone a language. If you ask, hey, can you help us translate this, you know, the instructions about material stewardship, or can you have at least one case study that's about climate change? As long as you can provide them some materials to do so and you're not asking them to do a really big lift, for most people, this is something that they're already doing and they're interested in, and it allows them to do something that feels really meaningful for them and for their students. And I think especially as students, so in the post-Trump era in the United States, students are so anxious about the future of the world that most faculty, I think, are seeing some way of addressing these anxieties explicitly is helpfully reassuring. It makes people not feel crazy, like I'm just the only one concerned about whether the country will exist, whether I'll be able to get my influence apply, whether, you know, all of these quite near and pressing issues. So a lot of it's kind of like, how can I take the things that I recognize that people I'm interacting with, not just students, but, you know, if I'm a faculty member, my colleagues, the staff I work with, that everyone's concerned about, and work them into the curriculum so we have an excuse to talk about them and figure out how we feel and how we're doing things and share this. So that part, people have been pretty interested in. It's trying to figure out how to say, can we share what you're doing to make it easier for someone else?
Does that anxiety that they're coming in with mean that you don't have to front load with Zoom? You don't have to go through the graphs, the hockey stick graphs, and the polar bear and the life's flow. And are you finding they've already got it?
Pretty much. I mean, and it's interesting. I think we've been grappling with this. This is one of the things that we try to do occasional faculty and staff retreats where we say, okay, what's working, what's not? And, you know, we've been trying to figure out, can we reduce the burden of sustainability reporting so that it's a fun happy hour or an outing or something that people enjoy doing, and mm-hmm. we can just humanly communicate about what we're doing rather than write
talk
reports.
To each other.
Right, it's just them talking to each other. And people have really appreciated that, and will try to come when they can. And I think we've seen a huge reduction in scare tactic. I mean, and in some ways, I've been thinking about this, listening to other scholars, because in some ways we sometimes, I think, lose the justification piece. And I'll come back to that in a minute. But I think so much so, I've just started a new class that's called the Planetary Home Care Manual. And I think this is a good example of this. So I thought that the point of the Planetary Home Care Manual was going to be that we wrote a little kit, kind of a manual to say, hello, other people I might interact with in the world. What do I need you to know if we're going to live as if we meant to stay here for a while together? So that's the premise of the course. So the first assignment, so students do small assignments, like they go out and they draw, or they make a small snippet of a radio podcast or something, and there's instructions. Here are different ways that you might exercise your exploratory faculties, but the outcome is up to you. And there's a big menu of things to draw from. You have to do a few to see. So first of all, is students have not been given permission to explore and to do things that they find pleasure and joy in. So it's partly a, let's not start with fear. Let's start with finding relief, joy, interest, curiosity. And then we go to a group project that's, how would you get someone to talk about climate change? Any way you want. And then we go back to some kind of individual skill building exercise. So things like, how do you offer as much as you think you're going to take in a group collaboration? Like, how can you be as supportive as you are needy? Or, you know, there are a lot of these kind of little group dynamic exercises, just reflection pieces. And then the final assignment we did in a World Cafe style, where people could just raise topics and then figure out what they wanted to work on. And almost all of them, it was really helpful for me to learn this. Almost all of the projects the students did were what I would think of as being almost like preparatory for learning about the bad things about climate change that we usually lead with. So there was a tissue box kit that explained, it would sit on your desk, it's designed for faculty to sit on their desks, and on the faculty-facing side or the staff-facing side, it would say things like, remember to ask consent before offering a hug, or possible lines you could use if someone comes to you in distress. And on the student side, it would say, or whoever is sitting at the desk, coming to your desk, here are ways to ask for emotional help when you feel stuck, to break down the stigma of this. And then the side of it has all little cards of different resource offices around campus and in the community that might be helpful for you. And then it's a tissue box. So it's an invitation to not feel alone in your emotional distress. And another project was a kit for putting your phone away, for realizing that you may not have a reorienting reflex when lost because you are part of a generation that's always grown up with a phone. And that one was one that I got reports for months where students would say, I put my phone away on the way back from my soccer practice and I let myself get lost. Or I was surprised to discover that I knew the way home. And I think there's a real generational issue where people in my generation and older grew up feeling like this was, like we saw it modeled, that, you know, the world is ending. And these are students who've grown up with the world already ending, and they need a moment to just take a breath and recognize the world is not ending right now. So, it's been a really interesting flip in some ways. So then what we're realizing is they're actually really bad. This is coming back to the point I paused for a minute. They're bad at making a persuasive argument because they assume everyone else also sees that the world is ending. And I think this is partly self-selection and who comes to learning institutions at this point. But to be able to actually say, here's the problem and here are its specifications and why it should matter to you, they just assume everyone else is in a panic about it.
So you have some self-selection. So I'm not sure how much of this a problem this is for you then, that the Planetary Home Care Manual sounds an awful lot like the Moosewood Cookbook. It sounds like a thing the hippies are going to do.
Mm-hmm.
How do you engage the young Trump supporters?
part of it was really interesting. So I've only offered it once. And I ended up having more business students than I expected. And in our institution, the business students would be the ones who would be most identifiable as Trump supporters. And part of what was fascinating about it is that they were almost... So one left on the first day. And I still am thinking about this because she also left one of my other courses when she saw that what we were going to read was the Seven Cheap Things, which is Raj Patel and Jason Moore's book on food, money, labor, care, basically the cheapening of everything. Mm-hmm. It's like, but I really don't think, especially if you're going to be an environmental studies student, that was an environmental studies specific class, that you can understand what's happening if you don't understand the history of capitalism. But all the other business students had been dragged into the class by their roommates. So I think that the peer-to-peer, I think, mm-hmm. you know, I've really been working on this. So part of what's fun about this position, so I think increasingly institutions are making us work two jobs. So I'm the director of environmental studies and I teach these courses, and then I'm the director of sustainability for the whole institution. But the fun part of that is that I spend a lot of time with student groups and with, you know, in the end, I do spend a lot of time with the operations side of campus. So I know the students who mow the lawns, and being able to do really fun stuff with them and to make these kits that are exploratory and rewarding means that they then bring their friends. And we have a concept, and one of the big questions we have is, why has environmental studies been traditionally such a white discipline? Why do we have, still, into 2019, we have this predominance of people who are going into natural resource management and who hunted or fished as children, but only the white ones. I mean, we have, at this point, especially in the metro Twin Cities, it's probably much more likely that you fish in the river if you're from a Southeast Asian family. What are the things that make environmental studies not legible to you as something that would be useful? So it's been fun to both figure out how to break down those barriers and have a more inclusive table, but also then to seed the same curricula into, say, a department like public health. So this fall I'll teach the Planetary Home Care Manual again, but I'm also teaching the junior and senior seminars for environmental studies as a collaborative course with public health, graphic design, and professional writing. And I'm really curious to see if that catches students that are much less self-selected.
We're running out of time, and I haven't left enough time to ask you the question. You said you're back to art after 20 years?
So I spent...
What are you doing?
I spent the winter at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and I had a whole plan to make diagrams and these kind of elaborate food system illustrations, because that's back on the question of land. And I ended up making a giant stuffed version of an aquifer because I feel like so much of this work ends up being writing reports, and it's linguistic and it's instructional. And to be able to have something that was gestural and people, it was a very puffy, fleece version of an aquifer that's in really dire straits in the United States. And the more you look at it, the worse the problems are. So something you could hug and feel, I guess this is my version of the kind of kit that I'm making my students read or make, is that you can do something that nourishes you before you have to put effort into something. So you can offer that to people before you ask them to be upset with you.
Okay, we've got 7 questions to end with and less than 7 minutes. What's your go-to definition of sustainability?
Our institution's definition. This is part of why I took the job, is the conditions under which all can thrive in the long term. Which is great, because you can be thrivier or less thrivy, and you can be more all or less all. It's actually kind of an actionable definition.
A nice definition. What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
After writing her an email every month for 3 years, the chief financial officer gave permission that we can start reporting on sustainability indicators for the university.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Yes.
Why is that?
I think social action and the relationships are the core of sustainability work, and that if we aren't in right relationship, and that relationship and process of relationship isn't what's foregrounded, the technical stuff won't work. So I feel like activism is really just another word for relationship building. And especially I think working in Minnesota, one of the big gifts has been getting to work with a lot of Indigenous colleagues and getting a very relational sense of land and society is essential to what allows people to live in place, especially over time.
Stephen Sterling's got nice stuff about relational sustainability education. What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
I have discovered that I have a surprisingly cheerful reaction to adversity. And part of what was really nice about going back into studio practice was a recognition that that can really wind you up to a very unsustainable level of stress. But it also has made me realize it's an unusual capacity. So to be able to share that with people, and then part of what I'm finally getting better at is to create a distributed network where my joy and curiosity can help get people over those administrative humps. You know, people don't all like to have to write to a CFO every month for 3 years. As I thought it was more and more interesting. How can I be especially compelling in this month's edition of the sustainability reporting
request?
Did you
keep saying, as I wrote to you last month?
Yes, and the month before. And I think this would be a really good idea, and here's why, and here's what your colleagues say. And
what is the biggest challenge you're looking forward to in the next couple of years?
Really concretely, I think part of what happens with sustainability work is that we get boxed into recycling again and again. So when I was hired, the mantra of the hiring committee was, this is not just about recycling. And then we get a new president. She was like, well, fine, but first get the recycling right. So we've spent the last 4 years working on recycling. But for the last 2 years, we've laid the groundwork for our recycling to be a springboard into energy conversations. So to be able to really think, how do you get people to pivot a little bit from what they recognize to things that are going to be, you know, and that they recognize as terrifying to something that's going to be much more terrifying? That will be challenging.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur tomorrow morning, what would you have happen?
From my institutional perspective, because I'm really embedded in that here, we would replace the steam plant that's 100 years old at my institution with a brilliant new energy, green energy plant. So institutionally, that, I think.
Bigger,
I would repeal Citizens United. I think that's done so much damage, and giving corporations entityhood is one of the main damages the United States governance has done in the world in the last couple of decades. And that's a big piece of this, is trying to get people from, you know, there, put my cell phone in a box, to how do we change policy at the federal and international level?
Or start giving rivers and national parks citizenshiphood as
well. Right. Well, we work a lot with the Hekua program on the North Island that brings students directly into that, and they come back and they're just on fire. So that relationship has really benefited our student body.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Work with people who are cheerful and find joy in the work. And I think learning that, I think recognizing it's a personality trait. It's not a virtue. It's just something some people have. But it really, it's really helpful for not becoming full of despair in this kind of work. And for remembering to prioritize the relationships and having fun and doing the joyful and creative things, because they really do help with the stress and the trauma.
Thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. This has been really interesting.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. I've been talking with Dr. Valentine Cadio, who is the Director of Environmental Studies and the Director of Sustainability at Hamline in St. Paul, Minnesota. You can find Sustainable Lens on sustainablelens.org. We've got an archive of nearly 400 conversations. And we're broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic. Proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.